Dr. David Brody is a professor of neurology and an associate professor of biomedical engineering at the Washington University School of Medicine. He received his MD and PhD from Johns Hopkins University. He's on the editorial boards of the Journal of Neurotrauma and Acta Neuropathologica. He's received millions of dollars in research funding examining the neuropathology of concussion from the National Institutes of Health and the Department of Defense. He has more than 50 publications in journals including Neurology, JAMA Neurology, Brain, and Neuroimage. We're really honored to have Dr. Brody presenting at this conference. Please join me in welcoming him.
Hi, thanks so much. It's the first time I'm meeting a lot of you guys, and it's really an honor to be invited to this group, so thanks for the invitation, Ruben. I really enjoyed Jim's talk, and I'm going to talk about something completely different that's really not related to science at all. This is going to be, what I'm going to talk about instead is my clinical practice, which is I run the concussion clinic at Washington University, and as Ruben said, this is clearly a multidisciplinary clinic, and we work with a lot of neuropsychologists and therapists and trainers and a huge variety of medical practitioners of all types. But what I wanted to tell you about, what I was invited to talk to you guys today about, is the pharmacological management of various neurological sequelae of concussive traumatic brain injury. And so I'm going to tell you that, let's see, okay, how do I do the next slide here? Got it. These are my mandatory disclosures as some research support, some consulting. None of these constitute conflict of interest, but the only thing that I will say just up front is that a lot of what I'm going to say today can be found in this book that we put together a couple of years ago called The Concussion Care Manual that's published by Oxford University Press. And so some more details, what I'm going to tell you about is just sort of the tip of the iceberg of all the things we do in the concussion clinic, and you can hopefully read about the rest of them. Okay, so the bottom line first. Most patients with concussions don't need any pharmacological therapy at all. But pharmacological treatments can be an adjunct to rehabilitation and lifestyle management interventions for the more complex concussion patients that have unusual or difficult sequelae from traumatic brain injury. There's no pharmacological cures. We can't cure concussion or any of these diseases with any of these concerns with pharmacology, but we can help some of the time. So sometimes they can be helpful. But some pharmacological interventions can be harmful, can do more harm than good. So sometimes knowing when to withdraw or take away some of the pharmacological interventions is a very helpful thing. And most importantly, this is not science. Most of what I'm going to tell you today is based on so-called expert opinion, which just means us making the same mistakes over and over again for more and more years. It's based on our experience and what we think has been working over a period of time. And the evidence is scanty, and there's a real great need for randomized controlled trials in this domain of treatment for specific problems following concussive traumatic brain injury. So the last thing I wanted to say is that I'd like this talk today to be interactive. So rather than asking me questions at the end, why don't you guys please stop me and ask me questions as we go through each slide, each domain. I think that'll be more interesting, more productive for you. What I'd really like to do is be able to answer your questions about that you may have and engage in a little bit of dialogue. So if that's okay with you, please, I'm going to stop and look for questions after each slide rather than at the very end. Okay? I actually don't have that many slides. Okay, so just going to get right into it. Probably the most common delayed and persistent complaint that I see in my concussion clinic is migraine. And migraine headaches. And just as was as Jim said earlier, these are often people that have had some background of migraine in the past, either genetic or personal history, but it's much, much worse after their concussion, and clearly so. And so what do we do? Well, in my clinic, we give triptans, just like we would for any other migraine, sumatriptan, zolmitriptan, et cetera. We give a lot of NSAIDs. We give acetaminophen. We give tramadol. Rarely we give butalbital or short-acting narcotics. Those are things we try to avoid whenever possible. We try to avoid medication overuse, which can make things worse, And we try to avoid routine narcotics and take people off of routine narcotics if we can. We try to avoid routine butalbital, and we definitely avoid long-acting narcotics. This is an example where we think we can make people worse if with some of these things, and other providers have made our patients worse as a result. But the way I'm drawing these things, you see these pizzas, these round blue pizzas that I've got up there. You notice that the pharmacology is drawn as 1/3 of the pizza, but the other 2/3 of the pizza are the non-pharmacological interventions. And so in the lower left side, these are all the lifestyle advice that we give patients and try to enforce lifestyle changes with our patients. And things like appropriate cognitive and physical rest and ice and quiet and dark rooms and relaxation therapy and meditation. We spend a lot of time focusing on that. And then the lower right quadrant is what our ancillary therapists, other medical professionals with whom we collaborate, are helping our patients with, or almost always referring to another provider who's going to provide additional care. And those are people that are teaching our patients relaxation training and meditation and biofeedback, for example, as a way to manage their migraines. Does that make sense? This, again, the basic structure of, you got pharmacological, lifestyle management, and other therapies. Okay, good. Questions right up front on this one. Yes, sure.
When do you draw the line?
Great question. So when do we draw the line of medication overuse? It's just exactly about right. 3 to 4 weeks, about a month of daily medications is about when we call it medication overuse. And if that's the case, if people are taking headache medications every day for 3 or 4 weeks, they now have a chronic problem, and they need to go on to the next slide, which is chronic migraine prophylaxis. Right on. So in that case, yeah, thank you. I'll slip you a 20 later. Perfect. In that case, clearly what they need is some prophylaxis, that the daily abortive treatments is really meant to be 3 times a week or less, not every day, or at least not every day for an extended period of time. And so migraine prophylaxis in the setting of concussive traumatic brain injury works really well. It works just as well, sometimes even better, than in the regular migraineurs that don't have traumatic brain injury. But the order of operations, the medications that we use are a little bit different, I find, than in regular migraine, those of you that have experience with migraine. We find amitriptyline overwhelmingly more effective than other pharmacological agents in the setting of post-concussive migraine. Whereas in the general population, I think topiramate is probably the most effective medication. We still use topiramate, but it tends to have more side effects in the concussion population than it is in the general population. So amitriptyline is our go-to drug for sure. But, you know, interestingly, recently, we've been going very early to botulinum toxin therapy injections because the side effects are really minimal, and we get a tremendous response to botulinum toxin. So after patients have failed their first 2 drugs, we're immediately referring them for Botox. We do use some propranolol and verapamil and difelproex and many other medications, but we're finding those, some of the ones on the lower part of the list there, to be less effective perhaps in the concussive populations than in the general migraine population. But the key point is to avoid impairing side effects. Oftentimes the side effects in this concussion population in terms of mood instability and cognitive dysfunction are worse than they would be in the general population. So a medicine like topiramate, which can cause some real cognitive side effects at high doses especially, those are often worse in this population. Same thing with valproic acid, can be okay in the general population, but I find more cognitively impairing in this population. Again, pharmacology is not the whole story. The non-pharmacological lifestyle of modifications, good quality sleep, we emphasize that really aggressively. Identifying and avoiding triggers like specific foods and excess alcohol and erratic caffeine use and dehydration and specific patterns of lights and noises. We spend quite a bit of time trying to identify triggers that can then be avoided and eliminated. On the ancillary side, we refer a lot for cognitive behavioral therapy, stress reduction, physical therapy for concomitant neck injuries, and meditation training, and relaxation training, and biofeedback, again, as part of the treatment for chronic migraine, to change the patient's lifestyle and thinking about their migraine so that they have ways to avoid it other than using the pharmacology, just as you said, Jerry, so they don't have to do it all the time. Yes, please. Yeah, that's a great question. So we have several different biofeedback groups within in the St. Louis community, and there doesn't seem to be a consensus about which ones are best. So I'll try to answer that question next year. But right now I can't say which ones are. There's a wide variety of practices, as you probably know. There's a wide variety of practices. I have not yet seen one that was an obvious winner that was so much better than any of the others. Please. So we're doing a very standard protocol, 25 locations around the head and three. I'm not personally doing it, but our providers are doing 25 locations around the head. And in most patients, two or three chase the pain where they feel like they're getting the most pain. But it's a very standard. It's very similar to the published protocols. These are our migraine doctors who are doing it very similarly to what they would be doing for a non-concussive traumatic brain injury patient. Does not require, I don't think, any additional training other than an already headache specialist Botox trainee. Yeah, please.
What are your thoughts on the timing, particularly post-concussion, based on the recovery?
Yeah, so I never start prophylaxis earlier than 2 weeks after concussion. So I'm always waiting for them to have persistent migraines more than 2 weeks after their concussion. Because, again, most of the patients are going to be okay within 7 to 10 days after their injury. The only rare exception to that would be somebody that had substantial migraine burden beforehand, it's just awful afterwards, and we know that there's a good chance that it's gonna be awful. And a lot of times those patients had been on prophylaxis before, and we're gonna either up their prophylaxis or get them back onto prophylaxis. But the most typical patient, honestly, that I see is somebody that has seen three other doctors, and it's a year out from their concussion or several years out from their concussion, and so there's no question that it's gonna be a chronic issue. But I have started prophylaxis as early as 2 weeks after concussion. Some of my colleagues think that's a little bit aggressive. Some of my colleagues won't start for 4 to 6 weeks after concussion. I don't claim that there's one right answer. I'm just telling you what we do. Yeah. Boy, there's a lot of questions back there, and I don't know who was asked first. So please, in the yes. Oh, absolutely. So I've got a whole slide on vestibular issues, and we certainly do. I can't say that I have found vestibular rehab particularly helpful for migraine. So I see your point, though, the point of your question. Sometimes when people have intermittent vestibular concerns, one of the questions is, are they migraine auras that are manifesting as vestibular abnormalities? And you can do a vestibular rehab all you like. If it's a migraine aura, that's a chronic spreading depolarization running through the brain. That's not going to solve the problem until you've addressed the underlying pathophysiology. So we do refer for vestibular rehabilitation, but we want to make sure our therapists thank us for treating the underlying migraine first before we refer them to therapy so that they can actually benefit from the therapy. Oftentimes, if we put them through aggressive visual rehabilitation, we actually can make migraines worse sometimes because those therapies are quite cognitively difficult. And they're very helpful, but we've got to address the migraine first before to get the best use of the therapy. And that's where I think pulling together as a team really helps, doing things in the right order. Does that make sense? That's not exactly the answer to your question, but that's what we do. Yeah, please. Yeah, so have I. And I didn't put that on here because I have not found that particularly effective in this patient population. I have definitely used that in non-traumatic brain injury patients. But I've not found it particularly effective in this patient population. There may be others who have more experience with it than I do, but that's not part of my common practice. Please. Yeah, I wish we knew. No, I don't think we, yeah, I don't know. Does anybody else here know? I've never seen a good explanation for it. Please.
I know.
Okay, good, thank you. yes, please. Oh. Yeah, so what do you do during those first 4 to 6 weeks while the medication is becoming effective? That's where all those other things go into play. Good quality sleep and learning how to avoid your triggers and learning how to avoid specific foods and lights and dehydration and the physical therapy and the stress reduction. That's where you start getting practice of all the other stuff. So remember, the pharmacology is just one third of the pie. If all you're doing is relying on that amitriptyline, you're only getting a third of your meal. Right, you're still going to be hungry at the end. Butterbur, unimpressed. Yeah, unimpressed. fever few, unimpressed. Yeah, it has that stuff has an okay dose of vitamin P, placebo. No, there are some randomized controlled trials that show that it has some benefit over placebo, but I have not been impressed in my own practice. Yeah, so I, yeah. Yes, please. Yes, yes, I do find that it's effective even in patients who are sleeping well. So I think that it's independent of the effects on sleep, and if we just treat the sleep, such as with Ambien or melatonin or something like that, that does not in and of itself have as big an effect on the migraine as the amitriptyline, in our experience. Yes, please. It's not a silly question at all. There are a lot of other types of headaches. There's a lot of tension headaches and neuropathic pain headaches and sinus headaches and trauma to other parts of the sensitive structures around the head and neck, and even occasionally cluster headaches that occur. The reason I focus on migraine headaches is that migraines are overwhelmingly the most common type and overwhelmingly the most disabling type. So the consequences of treating something that's not a migraine as if it were a migraine, and the answer is really oftentimes you can't tell completely. And oftentimes a patient can have more than one type at the same time. Okay, so the hallmark of a migraine headache is a unilateral, throbbing, severe headache that is accompanied by one or more of the following: nausea, vomiting, photophobia, phonophobia, or a neurological aura. And so a very large number of the severe headaches meet that criteria after traumatic brain injury. Now, there's no objective test for a migraine, so that's just a definition. That's just our listed definition. So we can never be absolutely sure. But my point is that if you're not quite sure what type of headache it is, it doesn't hurt to treat it like migraine because it's the most important, the most common, and the most disabling cause. And there's not much harm in doing so and a lot of potential benefit. So I'm often not sure, and I'll start a migraine prophylactic anyway if it's a disabling headache of an unknown type. And yeah, please. Yeah, carefully. So I start usually 25 milligrams once a day, and I've even given 12.5 milligrams very early. But I have in the past gone up to 100 to 150 milligrams of topiramate in some patients and tolerated okay. But on the other hand, I can just think of a patient that I saw the other day who we got him onto botulinum toxin therapy and his headaches got much better, and we took him off of topiramate and his cognitive function improved. So that was a really great thing to do, was get him onto the botulinum toxin so that he could get off of the topiramate. But then there's other patients, for example, who the topiramate doesn't seem to affect. I don't have a good way of predicting who's going to have cognitive side effects with topiramate and who's not. But recognize that it is a real possibility. Yeah, please. I think if you ask 7 neurologists about this topic, you'll get 8 opinions. It comes back to one of my very first slides, which is that we don't have a solid evidence base. So we do not have like a standard approach to practice. So I think as long as we're open-minded and we make sure that we're quantitatively tracking our patient outcomes and so that we can objectively say, okay, in this particular patient, what's working, what's not working, then I think there's room for exploration. The good news is that migraine headaches are not life-threatening, and so if you get the wrong medicine for the first 4 to 6 weeks, it's a drag for the patient, but it's not like the patient didn't die because you chose the wrong medicine up front. Yeah, they might feel like they're dying, but they didn't actually die. Okay, good. Well, that was good. Yes, please. It's primarily focused on relaxation. Most of our biofeedback practitioners are focused on relaxation of the muscles in the head and the neck, and using some and getting some calming state of reduction in the stress response, which we think underlies certainly the worsening of the migraine, if not necessarily the migraine itself. So they certainly tolerate. That's a good question. I don't know that I've seen any of our biofeedback practitioners focusing on that, but I'll ask though, and I'll tell you next year. I haven't. It's a good question. EMG based. Yeah. Please. Oh, yes, I did not put acupuncture on there. We are just starting to use, these slides are a little bit older. We are just starting to use acupuncture in St. Louis. We don't have a great community of acupuncturists in St. Louis area, but we are, I've learned quite a bit about this from my colleagues in the military. So even in, when I traveled a few years ago to Afghanistan, and their one of their mainstays of migraine, chronic migraine treatment was acupuncture in Afghanistan. And so it's something that I personally haven't enough experience with, but I'm excited about learning more. So do you find it helpful in this setting of chronic migraine? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. I don't have a lot of experience, and quite honestly, the thing that we're the most excited about these days is botulinum toxin, because we're getting the insurance companies to pay for it reliably now, and it's once every 3 months, and there's no persistent side effects. And so all the issues of do they take their medicines, are they compliant, and are they having side effects, are all just off the table. So it's very expensive, of course, but the insurance companies are paying for it these days. So it's not acupuncture, but it's that's the non-pharmacological part. Okay. But Keith Stussy, for example, Dr. Stussy in Afghanistan, was using a lot of acupuncture and finding a very, very good effects in military personnel. All right, good. So turning now to the topic of insomnia, as you know, many concussive patients have major complaints with regard to sleep. And in our hands, we always try to use non-pharmacological methods to manage insomnia first. So I've got that a bit wrong on this slide. But so specifically, we are using some sleep hygiene and some controlled caffeine and moderate exercise and avoiding excess alcohol, morning bright light therapy using a light box to control sleep. But probably the most effective thing that we're using in our clinic is cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia. This is really the big gun for insomnia is CBTI. We have a very good CBTI clinic and some physical therapy for pain control. Sometimes nighttime pain and positioning are serious issues that are causing insomnia. And then occasionally we're getting new onset of sleep disorders, parasomnias and restless leg syndrome and obstructive sleep apneas and central sleep apneas and REM behavioral disorders, a new onset after a traumatic brain injury. And so a full sleep study sometimes is indicated in somebody that has a complaint of insomnia. But again, this is the non-pharmacological interventions come first in chronic insomnia in our hands. But if we do turn to pharmacological interventions, we usually will try melatonin first. I cannot say that it's overwhelmingly effective. We often have to go to something that's a little bit bigger gun. And Lunesta and Ambien are the two big ones. Lunesta is probably the one that I'm favoring at the moment because it's having less of the odd behavior than Ambien can have. And trazodone and Rosuvastatin are also reasonable medications. And in the really, really refractory insomniac traumatic brain injury, concussion patient, we have had to use all of the above. So sleep is so important to the recovery from traumatic brain injury that we will pull out all the stops to get the patient to sleep well, because nothing else, many of our other interventions are not going to work until the patient starts sleeping well. So we really put a tremendous emphasis on sleep quality. And many of our therapists will tell us that their cognitive rehabilitation, their balance rehabilitation, their physical therapy rehabilitation is not taking. And then once we start to fix the sleep, then it starts taking. Then they start to make progress. So this is the team dynamics here. We avoid neuroleptics. I can't tell you how many people I've seen coming to me on Seroquel for sleep, which I think is harmful in terms of the recovery of the brain from injury. We also avoid excess alcohol as a trigger for sleep. We take a careful history. Some of our patients are using a bottle of Jack Daniels every night as their sleeping pill. That probably does not improve the recovery from concussion. But if you don't ask, you won't find out. We also avoid anticholinergics. There's a misperception in the general public, I think, that just because a medication is over the counter, like Benadryl, that it's safe. And in our hands, we find that the anticholinergic over-the-counter things like diphenhydramine, Benadryl, that's in the most of the popular over-the-counter sleeping aids is probably less effective and also has more side effects than the prescription medications. So we get our patients off of that stuff, and I would rather prescribe them Lunesta rather than having them take Benadryl, for example. Yes, please. As short a time as possible, but we don't take them off if they still need it. So it's not a very good answer, but I've had patients who have been on these medications for years and have not had, even though that's not the way they're FDA indicated, they're indicated for short-term use, we've had them on there for years without any obvious long-term side effects. So typically I'll have the patients do a course of cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia. If they need a medication in adjunctive, we'll do that. As they start to get really good at their cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia, as their therapist tells me, she's really good at it now, he's really good at it now, then we'll try to withdraw the medication and see what happens. If we withdraw the medication and they still don't need it, then we put them back on the medication. Because again, as I said, sleep quality is so important that I would rather them be sleeping. My longest term insomniac patient has been on meds for insomnia every night for something like 12 years. And he's alternating, going every other night, Ambien one night, Lunesta the other night, Ambien one night, Lunesta the other night, has not had any long-term consequences of that. Now, I'm not saying that's a good idea for everybody, but he was much, much worse when he did not take his sleep meds. So it was worth it in this case.
If you have questions, let us catch up to you. We have handhelds now that we can
make it easy. Yeah. I saw a question. Yeah. No?
I have a patient who's a medical student, and she's taking Benadryl, and she's up to quite a bit of Benadryl at night, combined with Klonopin. That sounds like a very dangerous combination.
I think those are in the avoid list, Benadryl and benzodiazepines.
She's obviously self-medicating, but she has a long history of severe insomnia, so always has been.
No, that's a really tough, those patients like that have a really tough long history of insomnia, that's where cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia is really the only, that's the mainstay of treatment. Because this is not fundamentally a pharmacological problem, fundamentally it's a behavioral problem. And so that's where I think is the number one domain. Yeah, please.
Have you been able to track a proportion of, those having new onset kind of insomnia problems versus those like pre-morbid in your clinic?
As a proportion, it's hard to say because my clinic is over-enriched for the unusual and severe and refractory. So take it for what it's worth. Most of the patients that I've seen have had a pre-existing some history of insomnia, which has gotten much worse after their injury. I would say that's the rule. Absolutely. So insomnia is so comorbid with anxiety and depression that we're very frequently treating them all together. So this all is this question of what do you treat first, the psychiatric condition or the neurological condition? The answer is both together. They don't really get better unless they're both treated together. But yes, there's a high base rate of anxiety disorders and depression in the people that have insomnia. But sometimes the insomnia is something as simple as just bad habits that they never learned properly. And sometimes it's something like it's really actually a pain issue, that as soon as you treat the pain, the insomnia gets substantially better. So you have to dig into this. This is why these initial office visits take an hour and a half a lot of the time. Yeah, please. Yeah, so it's not common that people wake up in the middle of the night with headaches, and it's a red flag. So as a neurologist, if somebody wakes up with a headache in the middle of the night, I'm going to look very carefully for another cause other than migraine. I mean, it does sometimes happen in migraine. Sometimes we don't find another cause. But most migraine headaches come on later in the day with cognitive activity, and they get better with rest and sleep. If the patient can sleep, sometimes that's what it takes to get rid of the headache. If a patient has that, I'm going to look carefully for or a headache that's worse lying down than it is standing up. That's also not typical of migraine. Most headaches get better when you lie down and worse when you stand up. So if it's worse lying down or awakening, I'm checking for another neurological problem. And No, not concussion. I'm looking for something other than migraine and other than concussion in that setting. Now, It's true that even though the incidence of a process that's raising intracranial pressure is very low, and the atypical presentation of a common illness like migraine is still more common than the typical presentation of an uncommon illness, even so, I'm still going to look for that uncommon illness. I'm going to look at the back of the eyes, and I'm going to do a careful neurological exam again, even if I've done one before. And I may be sending that patient for an imaging study of the brain, even if they've already had one, if they have new onset headaches that are waking them up in the middle of the night. Yeah. Please.
Other than these things not working, what are your triggers for ordering a sleep study?
Triggers for ordering a sleep study, for example, would include severe refractory fatigue, such that even if they're getting enough sleep at night in terms of hours spent in bed or hours spent nominally asleep, but they're still not getting refreshing sleep, that's what's making me think that maybe they have a sleep apnea or a restless leg or a parasomnia. Or, you know, any symptoms that are concerning for narcolepsy, you know, cataplexy, you know, collapsing, for example, or sudden attacks of sleepiness during the day, that triggers a sleep study right away. But off, the most common reason that I'm ordering a sleep study is daytime fatigue. People who are exhausted, that all the normal routine, all the normal mediations for fatigue that we do are not working. Yeah. All right. Okay. Attention deficit. This is, sorry, yes.
I know that in a lot of athletes, if you take them out of play or out of their game, sleep is really easily disrupted no matter what kind of injury they have, whether it's a brain injury or a limb injury. So are you using any sort of mild or gentle exercise to help with the insomnia?
Oh, absolutely. So exercise withdrawal is a major cause of insomnia. And I think I've got that actually on line number three of the left lower quadrant, moderate exercise. So I prescribe moderate exercise for these athletes. And I order them to do it. I actually write it out on a prescription pad. 30 to 60 minutes of moderately intense exercise 6 days a week, whether you feel like it or not, as a prescription. And I send them to the physical therapist to find something that they can do with their injury. I have them work with a personal trainer to find something that they can do so that they don't overdo it. But yes, I prescribe exercise for athletes because I think exercise withdrawal is a substantial cause of insomnia and anxiety disorders.
In the case of concussions, how soon do you start that?
Well, typically, I'm not really seeing them for at least the first 2 weeks. So I'm usually the second or third person that they see. They've seen a sports medicine doc or a primary care doc. And the people that are refractory to the first line normal therapy are the ones who get to see me. On the rare occasion that I'm seeing somebody front off, you know, if it's a called in special favor, I'm having them start very small amounts of exercise on the second day and then a little more on the third day and the fourth day. And I'm doing the classic ramp up in their exercise during the first week. This is the 2 week or more mark. And quite honestly, a lot of the patients I'm seeing are 6 to 12 months or more out from their initial concussion and concussions, and they've had a long spell, and we're rehabilitating them. We're treating their deconditioning as much as anything else. All right, good. So attention deficit. This is probably the most common cognitive dysfunction that I see in concussion patients. Many patients who have pre-existing attention deficit, it's substantially worse, and patients who have not had a history of attention deficit diagnosed prior to their injury can have new onset attention deficit. And it's in all ages. I've seen new onset attention deficit even in middle-aged or elderly concussion patients. So it's not just kids. So an attention deficit is both one of the most gratifying things to treat and also a little bit one of the most scary things to treat. And this is where, and again, I'm going to say this as a caveat, the pharmacological aspects of attention deficit treatment are very controversial. There are many people who think that what I do is a little bit of a cowboy behavior because I give a lot of stimulants. I treat very aggressively with stimulants for attention deficit. But nonetheless, there are also quite substantial non-pharmacological approaches to treating attention deficit. Cognitive rehabilitation and meditation training are helpful. Environmental distraction control, cardiovascular exercise, as we discussed, stopping use of alcohol, good quality sleep, meditation, and diet can be very helpful with regard to treatment of attention deficit. Nonetheless, overwhelmingly, the most effective treatment for attention deficit are the direct stimulants. This is Ritalin and Adderall and Vyvanse and a wide variety of other preparations. These, when used properly, can be life-changing for patients that have disabling attention deficit after their concussive brain injuries. We also use caffeine as a stimulant. We prescribe specific approaches to using caffeine. It's the oldest stimulant in the world, and it's very effective if used exactly right. We use Strattera a little bit. We've not been particularly impressed with Strattera and concussion. Modafinil, people ask about modafinil a lot, Provigil. Modafinil is a wakefulness-promoting agent. If the problem is the patients are falling asleep, then modafinil is very helpful. But if they're wide awake but can't pay attention, modafinil is really not that helpful in our hands. Donepezil and rivastigmine, the acetylcholinergic acetylcholinesterase inhibitors, have a small adjunctive role for attention deficit. They can have a small benefit in addition to a stimulant or in a patient for whom a stimulant is contraindicated. But let me tell you, the really important thing is that stimulants are not for everybody. Stimulants are contraindicated in people who have active coronary artery disease, active cerebrovascular disease, uncontrolled anxiety, uncontrolled migraines, uncontrolled psychosis, very severe weight loss. They can be used safely in a very large number of patients, but not in everybody. And they are truly contraindicated. They can be truly harmful if used in the wrong patient population. And if they're overused or misused, they can also be truly harmful. So they're like a two-edged sword, really effective and real potential for harm. Yes, please.
Without people who are presenting with any type of seizures, what about the use of bupropion or Wellbutrin? I see a lot of that coming into the clinic as well for my sports physicians.
For specifically trying to treat attention deficit.
And possibly, it's usually comorbid with some type of mood issues.
Yeah, because I've seen those treated for mood issues, but I've not seen that used for attention deficit, bupropion, so much. It's possible that there's a literature that I'm not aware of, but I've not done that. Except, I mean, for mood, yes, I hear what you're saying. Yeah, please.
Can you talk a little more about how you use caffeine? I work with a lot of collegiate athletes who, if those types of medications would be helpful at their NCAA athletes, you can't just start Strattera or Adderall or Ritalin, without documentation and testing and things. So other strategies like caffeine, if you've already used the behavioral strategies, something like that would be really useful.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So I totally hear you. So the way I've used caffeine typically is have them use a first slug of caffeine, whatever that turns out to be, 12 to 16 ounces of regular coffee, first thing in the morning, and another one right after lunchtime, but then no caffeine after more than 8 hours before bedtime. And I have them use caffeine 6 days per week, not seven, so that they always get one whole decaffeinated day, which prevents them from getting tolerant to it, which prevents them from tachyphylaxing to it. And now everybody's tolerance to caffeine is different. Some individuals, a small coffee, a 6 ounce coffee, for example, or a shot of espresso, which is 50 milligrams of caffeine, as opposed to a big coffee, which is 100, 150 milligrams of caffeine, is the right amount. And then some people really do require more than that. And so it's not wrong to be using 4 to 6 caffeinated drinks per day, as long as there's none within 8 hours of going to sleep, and as long as it's 6 days per week, not seven, and 51 weeks a year. I also recommend that my patients take one whole week off of caffeine each year. I do that myself, and it's painful, but it's actually very helpful in terms of keeping one's tolerance for caffeine, because the problem with caffeine is that you just start using more and more and more of it because people get tolerant to the effects. So it has to be done carefully to avoid that. Yeah, please. Yeah, I think so.
Given the expectation for relative quick recovery in a mild concussion, are you prescribing these medications short-term or long-term?
These are all, let me unpack your question about it. Given the expectation of quick recovery for mild concussion, so I don't see anyone with mild concussion. People that have mild concussion and quick recovery, I don't even see them. So these are all people that have not had quick recovery, and these are all people that have not mild concussion. So I don't use any pharmacology at all in people that have mild concussion. Does that answer your question? And so So sometimes these are short-term use, and sometimes this is lifelong use. Sometimes this is 6 to 12 months, and let's see what happens. But I've had patients who've been on stimulants for years with no long-term side effects as long as they're used properly. Yeah, I'm just going to give my biases here. The definition of mild is soft or gentle. So my patients don't describe it that way. They find that as a pejorative term to call it mild. If you call it mild, they find that insulting, to be honest, because this is not mild. This is changing their lives. There are people, but again, I don't see the people who are fully resolving within 7 to 10 days. They never come to see me. So these are substantial concussions, the people that I'm seeing. We may have another talk. I don't think there's any role for pharmacology at all in people that have the true mild, fully resolving terms. Does that make sense? Yeah, okay. Yeah, please.
Given that you're in a protracted recovery clinic, as you said a couple of times now, how many patients do you see with attention deficit symptoms that are potentially borderline, maybe conversion symptoms, conversion cognitive symptoms, or you know, family discord, getting out of school, sort of maybe somaticizing, that nature?
Yeah, boy, that's a tough question. First of all, there's no way to tell for sure who has a conversion symptom and who doesn't, right? There's no gold standard test. I would say that probably a third of my patients have some potential for secondary gain. Either they would like to get out of school, or they'd like to get out of work, or they have a workman's comp case, or I've done medical legal cases. But most of my patients really would like to get back to their lives and like to get back to what they're doing. So I've probably prescribed stimulants for about 200 patients, and I've had to fire two of them because of abuse of the stimulant medication. And I've probably had 10 or 15 that I thought for sure were malingering or trying to get out of something or having some secondary gain as the primary driver of their symptoms. So that's just my opinion. I can't say how many of the rest of them were fooling me. But nonetheless, I don't want to withhold something from patients who really need it because I'm afraid of giving something to somebody who might not be, may have more than one thing going on. You know what I mean? These are, as long as they don't have contraindication, as long as there's no contraindication. If there's a contraindication, then I'm not gonna do it. But this is the controversial part. This is where people call me a cowboy, is that I may be prescribing stimulants to more people than actually need them. But I'm okay with that because I can't really tell who those people are. So if you have a great way to figure that out, I'd love to know.
Just to perseverate on this a bit more, because we have difficult decisions about what to do with people who have, let's not even use mild, a concussion,
right,
who isn't recovering in an expected way, and we then have to come in with other non-neurologic etiologies sometimes to figure out what's going on. But I think what I'm hearing you say is that you treat people kind of regardless of etiology as long as there was some concussive event, but it could be a mood disorder or, you know, a migraine disorder. But when we're dealing with athletes and making decisions about return to play and how to maximize their potential to return to play without hindering their neurological status, this gets really, really tricky. So I think it's important for us to have a better feel for the kind of person that you're seeing so that we don't carry away the message that this is a typical kind of post-concussive response. This is a aberrant, but real. It's real, but it's not necessarily a neurological or brain-based response. Is that fair?
Okay. First of all, these are not typical. That's absolutely true. So I would probably say that only 10 to 20% of the people that have a simple concussion fall into this category. But increasingly, we're seeing people that have had 3 to 100 lifetime concussions, and they're commonly represented in this group. Increasingly, we're seeing people that have had a prior history of attention deficit or migraine or mood disorder who then have a concussion, and this worsens their pre-existing condition. So that's in that sense, I agree with you. This is not the majority of patients. This is, as I said, I think on the very first slide, the grand majority of patients, no pharmacology is needed at all. But then I am going to take, so I'm agreeing with you on that point. But I'm going to take issue with you when you say that it's not brain-based. It's all brain-based. There's nothing else it could be, unless you have a dualist view of the world. But it isn't necessary. We don't know for sure whether it is due to this specific concussion or whether it had something to do with their early childhood or their genetics or the three other previous concussions that they may have had or their history of alcohol abuse or their sleep deprivation or their stress with their girlfriend, which has a big influence on their hypothalamic pituitary axis and affects the structure of their, the chemical structure of their brain. It is the brain, after all. So that's right. I can't untangle that. Nobody can. But I'm still going to try to help my patient get better.
By brain-based, I don't mean that there isn't a brain component, but what is the key etiologic factor? That's all.
I'm agnostic about that. And I don't think it matters. I think we treat our patients, we help them get better, agnostic to etiology. And I tell the lawyers, I'm going to help the patient get better, but I'm not going to be able to tell you the cause. Yeah, please.
So a lot of the patients that are referred to our clinic have seen, say, the pediatrician or somebody else, their family practice doc. And if they had pre-existing ADHD and were on stimulants, the physician has pulled them off their stimulants immediately post-concussion to let their brain recover. Now, of course, they come in on top of having a concussion with all the post-concussion issues. Now they're off the stimulant that they take every day, and they're having a horrible time concentrating.
Imagine that.
Yeah, it's shocking. What would you tell your patients about continuing on their regular stimulant medication that they had been prescribed normally, even immediately post-concussion?
The question of how long to rest after concussion is really, really controversial. Many of us were at a meeting in Pittsburgh recently where the discussion about length of rest was raised, and shorter and shorter rest periods are now being advocated. And so I can't tell you the absolute scientific answer to that question because there is no scientific answer to that, but I have patients go back onto stimulants as soon as I see them, which, as I say, is usually a couple weeks. I've been in that situation, too, where they were taken off their stimulants, and I've usually told them to go back onto their stimulants. I don't really know what the best answer to that is. A period of rest is probably a good idea, but how long that period of rest is hasn't been addressed. And whether you should start off with a small dose of the stimulant and ramp back up over that first week, I don't know. But I hear what you're saying. It's a tough one.
Is there harm to putting them back on the stimulant after?
Not that I've ever seen. I mean, the only question would be whether there would be harm. In my mind, the question would be, is there harm to putting them back on the stimulant in the first 24 hours? And that I would be a little bit concerned, I guess, about that. Because we do usually recommend that people rest for 24 hours. But again, we don't have a firm evidence base for that. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, but how soon is right back on? Like immediately, same day? Not even 24 hours? Yeah. Well, that's an interesting point. So, we'll have to think about that a little bit more. I don't have a good answer. Yeah. Please.
Can you comment on the use of amantadine? So, not necessarily for ADHD or attention deficit, but I see physicians using it a few weeks out for cognitive capacity, fogginess, attention problems, and then some use it just for a couple weeks, some keep kids on it for months.
Yeah. I've been pretty, in concussion patients, I've been pretty underwhelmed by amantadine. I've put lots of people on amantadine. I've never seen anything happen. Unlike the stimulants where it's crystal clear that something happened, might be good or might be bad, but something happened. The amantadine data is as follows. In patients with very severe traumatic brain injury, meaning that they were still in a state of reduced consciousness at the time that they were admitted to the inpatient rehabilitation facility, then a randomized controlled trial of amantadine showed that their recovery of consciousness was a little bit faster on amantadine. And then when they stopped the amantadine after, I believe it was 6 weeks or something like that in the study, the other patients caught up. So it was a rate of recovery of consciousness. And so then from there, the amantadine has then been extrapolated to all sorts of cognitive concerns with regard to traumatic brain injury. So it's not part of my, the only times that I've used amantadine and thought it had some benefit was for fatigue. But, and that's been known from the multiple sclerosis literature for quite a while in the setting of fatigue. But I find amantadine pretty underwhelming. It's pretty safe, though. All right. As if this is even more fun, let's get into a really controversial topic. Mood instability. This is one of the hallmarks of people with refractory concussive disorders is mood instability, where they're really, this is oftentimes what their families complain about most, is that patients are moody. Their mood regulation there is not the same as it used to be before their injury, and it can be persistent. Cognitive behavioral therapy is probably the best treatment for mood instability, and this is what we go to first if we can. Sometimes the mood instability in some of my most extreme patients can be so severe as to be life-threatening, dangerous to themselves or others. So we've admitted patients to the hospital because of mood instability, a psychiatric hospital, because of mood instability that was new onset after concussive injury. This is what everybody worries about, right, in a retired athlete who's had multiple concussions, is that they're going to do something dangerous to themselves or others because of dysregulated mood. And so it is not bad, it's not wrong to just say, this is dangerous, that you need to be admitted to the hospital. Don't be afraid, just because you're not a psychiatrist with admitting privileges, to say this patient needs to be admitted to a psychiatric hospital. This is about judgment. I think it's dangerous to continue treating a patient as an outpatient when there's a risk to themselves or others. Hopefully we can get our patients to the point where that never gets to be a risk. We can prevent them from becoming dangerous to themselves or others. Cardiovascular exercise, stopping alcohol. I think in patients that have severe mood disability, dysregulation, I don't think any amount of alcohol is safe, because one leads to too many. Good quality sleep and meditation can be helpful, adjunctive, non-pharmacological parts of treatment for mood instability. But in people that have severe mood instability, and I'm going to emphasize, this is a rare, small subset of the concussive population that I see in my patients, but you all see a few of these too. If you see 100 patients, you'll probably have one that has really disabling mood instability. So then we are using pharmacological management in addition to the non-pharmacological tools. The two drugs that I use the most are lamotrigine and oxcarbazepine. These are two anti-epileptic medications that have well-known mood stabilizing properties, and importantly, relatively minimal cognitive side effects. Unlike some of the other mood stabilizers, such as lithium or atypical antipsychotics, propranolol, carbamazepine, which can have more side effects than Lamictal and oxcarbazepine. These are the ones that have the least effects on cognition, weight, and headache. So Lamictal, you guys are familiar with Lamictal. The tricky part about Lamictal is that it takes so long to titrate. It'll take about 2 months to get a patient up to full therapeutic dose of Lamictal. So in an urgent situation, Lamictal is not a great choice. So oftentimes I'll start oxcarbazepine first, if there's a more urgent issue. Trileptal can be effective quickly. You just have to draw sodium levels to make sure that it's not causing hyponatremia, and getting patients into cognitive behavioral therapy and stopping alcohol and getting exercising and a good quality sleep, et cetera, for the mood instability. So I do think these are effective. I've had patients who were able to, this was the issue that was preventing them from returning to play or returning to school or returning to work, was the mood instability. And we've had patients been able to return to those activities once we had appropriate management. One of the mistakes that I see is people who have erroneously think that what they're seeing is depression when in fact it's mood instability. Depression, the characteristic of major depression, is that the mood is low most of the time persistently. Whereas mood instability, it's not that the mood is low persistently, it's that it can be very low, but it can also be too high, and it can fluctuate, it can be overreactive. It's life circumstances happen and the person overreacts to it. That's the characteristic of the mood instability. And so I think it's a mistake to treat it as major depression if, in fact, it's mood instability. Antidepressants are not as effective for mood instability as mood stabilizers. No surprises there. I'm a neurologist, but I'm still comfortable doing this, even though this is usually what most people think of as the domain of the psychiatrists, is treating mood instability. I don't think this is rocket science. This is the SSRIs made depression and anxiety treatable by non-psychiatrists, and I think Lamictal and oxcarbazepine make mood instability treatable by non-psychiatrists also. Ooh, I was expecting like a gazillion hands all of a sudden, because this is actually one of my most controversial slides in some audiences. All right, well then, I've gotten Vici all down. Nonetheless, Ruben, how long do we have, by the way?
Five more minutes.
Okay, perfect. Nonetheless, despite the fact that not everybody who has a mood disorder has depression, there are people who do have real major depression after traumatic brain injury. I've heard it described as like being like having a dementor in the room by a young teenager during the Harry Potter era. So like really bad depression, like seriously awful, the worst thing that you can possibly imagine, depression after their brain injury. And these were patients that don't all have a prior history of depression. It's not common. This is a small subset of traumatic brain injury patients, but be aware that this can happen. The non-pharmacological options are really important. Again, you're seeing these over and over again: cardiovascular exercise, sleep, meditation, avoiding excess alcohol, cognitive behavioral therapy, supportive therapy, inpatient hospitalization if they're dangerous to themselves or others, good quality pain control, and training in meditation, training in relaxation, biofeedback for depression. But if necessary, serotonin-specific reuptake inhibitors can be just as effective in a traumatic brain injury patient with depression as in any other patient population. We use all of them similarly, sometimes adjunctive mood stabilizers. Sometimes, interestingly, stimulants can be a good adjunct to major depression treatment if the patient has a very lethargic, low-energy depression. Sometimes we'll use an activating antidepressant like fluoxetine and a small dose of a stimulant like Ritalin in that patient population. Occasionally, we'll use a small dose of an antipsychotic, rarely, I would say, in truly refractory depression. We have a randomized controlled trial that's starting at Washington University of transcranial magnetic stimulation for refractory depression after traumatic brain injury. We think that we've treated a few patients and found that to be effective. I didn't put that up here, but that's something that's cooking. We even had one patient that required ECT after her traumatic brain injury. That wasn't a concussion. That was a more severe injury. Okay, anxiety and post-traumatic stress disorder. I work a lot with the military, and since I started working with the U.S. military, seeing our U.S. service members who were injured in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan coming back, post-traumatic stress disorder was a virtually ubiquitous comorbidity with their traumatic brain injuries. Once my eyes were open to post-traumatic stress disorder, I started seeing it everywhere. I started seeing a lot of civilians with post-traumatic stress disorder. If you ask the right questions, you'll find a substantial number of people have flashbacks and re-experiencing and avoidance behavior and emotional numbing after their traumatic brain injuries. And so we think that there's a role for treating post-traumatic stress disorder in some of these patients. And again, cognitive behavioral therapy and prolonged exposure therapy are the mainstays of that treatment. But if pharmacological treatment is required, the anxiolytic SSRIs like paroxetine and sertraline are helpful. Prazosin is helpful for nightmares. If a patient is having disabling nightmares, waking up at night, maybe not from a headache, but actually from a horrible nightmare related to the sport injury or the car crash or whatever it was, then prazosin is helpful in that regard. Short-term benzodiazepines are sometimes helpful in this regard. This is the only circumstance, disabling PTSD or anxiety are the only circumstances where I think benzodiazepines can be helpful, and then only short-term. And again, mood stabilizers and very rarely antipsychotics. We try to avoid levetiracetam. Some people get put on Keppra for risk of seizures or put on Keppra if they think they're as a migraine prophylactic occasionally. We try to avoid that because that's mood destabilizing. And by the way, I should have said that on the previous slides as well. That can be destabilizing in patients with other mood disorders as well. So we do take people off of Keppra quite a bit and put them onto other agents if we think that's the issue. A controversial point here is that for a long time we've believed that stimulants were automatically contraindicated in patients with anxiety or post-traumatic stress disorder, but the recent experience from the military is that that's not the case, that they don't, their post-traumatic stress disorder does not automatically worsen when they're put on a stimulant. So if the stimulant is really indicated, give it a try and just watch them carefully. And if their PTSD and anxiety gets worse, well, then it obviously did. But a lot of times it does not get worse. It could actually be helpful for their other issues with regarding attention deficit. All right. And this is the last treatment slide, and then I'll wrap up. Fatigue is really important and can be quite disabling in these refractory, unusual traumatic brain injury patients. And I actively treat fatigue if the fatigue is the actual limiting factor. Now, of course, before I'm treating fatigue per se, I'm checking to make sure that it's not a sleep disorder or that it's not a mood disorder or that it's not an issue with alcohol use. So, but if not, then gentle reinstatement of cardiovascular exercise under supervision, so that no matter how tired they are, to gradually treat the deconditioning aspects of fatigue with cardiovascular exercise, cognitive behavioral therapy, and insight-oriented therapy. Sometimes there's an unrecognized mood disorder. And avoiding sedating medications. Surprisingly, people who are very fatigued and they're taking Benadryl every night. Well, yeah, I mean, no surprising they're fatigued in the daytime. And avoiding withdrawal from stimulants. Again, no surprising if somebody is withdrawing from their stimulant that they're fatigued. But in the really disabling fatigue cases, I will treat with direct stimulants and caffeine and amantadine and modafinil and fluoxetine and venlafaxine for the fatigue itself as explicitly. Now, it's not easy to get insurance companies to pay for some of these things because fatigue is not an indication. It's not a disease. It's a symptom. But nonetheless, I think this can be quite helpful. So I'm going to wrap it up and give you the bottom line again. The bottom line again is most patients with concussions do not require any pharmacology at all. So I don't want you to come away with the idea that Brody treats every concussion patient with pharmacological treatments. Most patients do not require any pharmacology. Nonetheless, if your patient does require pharmacology, there is quite a big bag of tricks that can be used that can actually be quite helpful. But in every case, the pharmacology is an adjunct to the lifestyle management and the non-pharmacological therapeutics that are used in these complex sequelae. There are no pharmacological cures. None of these diseases are cured, but they can be very helpful if used properly, and some pharmacological agents are harmful and should be withdrawn. And the best thing you can do is to get your patient off of some of your drugs in a lot of cases. And then finally, the last bottom line is that everything I said just now is just my opinion, no more. Do not think of this as an evidence-based field. It is not. Thank you.